Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. This week, a team of reporters with NPR and the Center for Public Integrity reported that many places in America still struggle with toxic air pollution some 20 years after the Clean Air Act came along. The four-part series, Poisoned Places, Toxic Air, Neglected Communities, shows that almost 400 power plants, refineries, chemical plants, and other industrial facilities are high-priority violators of the Clean Air Act now, and half of those plants are in six states: Texas, Illinois, Louisiana, Wisconsin, Indiana, and Ohio. And starting in 2004, the federal EPA began keeping a list of high-priority violators, a secret list. Later on, we'll hear from the Ohio EPA about the list and Ohio's struggles with air pollution. We'll also talk with an Ohio environmental activist whose work spans the generation of the Clean Air Act. Joining us now is national NPR reporter Elizabeth Shogren. She's been covering environmental issues for NPR since 2005, and before that was a Washington Bureau reporter at the Los Angeles Times covering environmental issues, the White House, and Congress. Welcome, Elizabeth.
Great to be here.
There was an unexpected discovery during the investigation for this series. The reporters learned that since 2004, the federal EPA has maintained a secret watch list of Clean Air Act violators or something. Can you tell us about that list and what it means?
Yes. In 2004, the agency was getting a lot of heat for not cracking down soon enough on chronic violators of pollution laws. And so the officials then, under the Bush administration, decided to create a watch list so that when there were plants that were known to be violating rules and laws, that they would pop up basically in front of headquarters in Washington, D.C., so that they would know that there are these violators out there that have been violating at least 9 months or made known to be violating for at least 9 months. So they created this list, and they use it. Now they're nearly 400 plants on the list right now, and they use it to make sure that states and regional officials from EPA are doing all they can to bring these plants into compliance.
Can you have they given you an example of how they've used a list in the past?
Well, you know, it's interesting because, of course, this list has been secret until now. We're the first group that's actually published the list, and EPA wasn't very. It came out as a result of a FOIA request that one of my partners put in, and this and EPA was not that eager to get this list out even now, and so they didn't actually give us a lot of details about how they've used the list in the past. And I think they're also very squeamish because they don't want to call out certain companies. Part of the way the EPA tries to clean up toxic pollution around the country is by getting collaboration with state agencies and also with companies. I mean, the laws are there, but actually, the fastest way to get a company to clean up is to get it to agree to do something so you don't have to drag them into court. So the EPA doesn't like to make companies angry at them. Already it's an adversarial situation because the EPA is making them spend a lot of money. It can be multi-million dollars on pollution controls to keep toxic air emissions and other kinds of air pollution from communities. So there is this tension there, and I think EPA wasn't really very eager to give us anecdotes about how they managed to crack down on one industry or another. But we did dive deeply into the stories of several communities that have been struggling with toxic air emissions. And in those communities, while we don't know exactly what role the watch list played, we do know what role EPA played in those areas. And sometimes EPA's power, both its scientific power and its legal power, has helped states come in and clean up very chronic, dangerous pollution problems.
And sometimes it doesn't wield that power very much, or it takes a long time to convince the U.S. EPA to do anything, to even start testing some plants. How does that process? How did you find that process works 20 years after the Clean Air Act was enacted?
Well, I think it's amazing to me that 20 years after the Clean Air Act was strengthened to clean up toxic air emissions, that some of the biggest polluters of toxic air emissions, I'm thinking now about power plants, there still aren't rules that require them to reduce toxic air emissions. EPA is working on them, but still, we're talking about 21 years later. And so because of that, without the rules that basically provide a map to companies requiring them to make certain changes, you know, it's difficult, I think, in many cases for state regulators and federal regulators to crack down. There are other really difficult things about the way the system works. Instead of requiring all companies to in real time monitor how much pollution is flowing from their facilities, EPA in many cases lets them estimate how much toxic emissions are flowing out. I did a story about one plant where the toxic emissions were 30 times greater than what the plant had been admitting to the EPA. So the EPA also lets them self-report their pollution.
In that case of the 30 times greater, how was that discovered? The EPA went behind them and double-checked, or did someone else?
Well, this story will air this afternoon and on All Things Considered, and it's all because a bunch of local people, and many of them sick, got together and did their own air testing and then pushed and pushed and pushed to get first the state and then the federal government to start addressing the problem. And even after they realized there was a serious risk because of high levels of benzene in their air, it took regulators 5 years to really respond, and the response is still ongoing now. So it's not necessarily easy, but what is clear is that there is a lot of data available on the internet that EPA makes available, and NPR now has this amazing map posted that shows thousands of facilities across the country that are releasing toxic air emission into the air, and that you can go to that NPR map and see what's in your neighborhood, and then follow a link, and it will tell you more about what kinds of toxic chemicals are being released by this plant. And the community that I saw in action in Tonawanda, New York, showed me that if communities are concerned, they can make a difference. And that's partly because the law is written to give them power. And it's not just a fluke. In fact, I think when Congress was writing the Clean Air Act, they realized that toxic air pollution makes people sick. It can cause cancer. It can cause birth defects. It can cause infertility. And these are things that people should be able to have a role in addressing in their own communities. And so there's still power that I think a lot of people don't know they have.
There's a conflict, though, and it shows up often between the relationship between the federal EPA and state EPA agents, EPA regulators, and that's between the desire and the imperative to create jobs and make companies want to settle in your state, and versus the danger that they could bring with them.
Yes, and I think you're kind of hitting the nail on the head of why we are two decades out and we still have many communities that face a lot of toxic air emissions. And I think the reason is that it's very natural that local governments want to encourage economic growth, and they want to encourage business, and businesses are very important to them, so they don't want to they don't want to make them mad at them. And so that's part of why the system was created, to have EPA basically looking over the shoulder of the states. The states are the frontline regulators on air pollution, but there are sometimes when the states, for whatever reason, don't crack down, and there are all different reasons, and each story is different. I don't want to say it's all the same, but sometimes the states don't crack down. Sometimes it's because they might disagree with EPA about what the laws really say. Sometimes it might be because they really don't want to offend a really important employer in their community. The stories are all different, but it's clear that the way the system is set up, it does give EPA the power to step in if the states are failing to protect people. But, you know, that's if they know about the problem, if it raises to their level of concern. In the case that I focused on most closely, on a coke plant in New York, the EPA didn't know about the problem. The state says it didn't know about the problem. And so sometimes it's just the proof isn't there. And one of the big reasons for that is the bad monitoring that I was talking about mm-hmm. earlier. And I spoke with a lot of lawyers who in EPA and who used to work for EPA, and they explained who are enforcing these laws, and they explained a lot of the challenges that they're up against. And one of them is exactly this relationship tension that you're talking about. And one of the plants that I focused on in my first story on was an Ohio plant near Cleveland called Avon Lake. It's a Genon power plant, which is a very big emitter of toxic air pollution. And part of the reason is it's an older plant, and it hasn't had to put on the modern pollution controls that other plants have to put on. And now EPA is saying that this plant has to clean up. When I talk to the state, it doesn't sound like they have the same opinion about this plant. They tell me the plant is complying with the rules as far as they see. So there's a little bit of tension there, and there that shows how things can, and that tension is going to delay any cleanup. And I don't know what's going to happen, and that's the case of that now, particular plant.
Is that Avon Lake plant one of the ones on the list, the secret list?
It is on the watch list, and that's why I focused on it in the story, mm-hmm. because I was kind of curious. It was, near the top of the toxic emitters on our watch list. We didn't do a very careful analysis of that in the end, so I can't tell you what mm-hmm. number it was, mm-hmm. but it was in the, it was one of the biggest toxic emitters on that list, and it also shows the tension between states and the federal government. And it was, I believe, just this summer when the EPA told the plant that it's violating, and the plant disagrees with the EPA's opinion. So there is a tension there.
There were other explanations. A lot of the company, you tried to contact every single entity named in that list, and some responded and some didn't, and some responded with, "We don't even know what you're talking about."
Right. Well, there's a reason for that, because the EPA's list was secret until now. And one of the reasons they kept it secret is because they wanted to keep the element of surprise in criminal enforcement. I mean, sometimes when plants are violating, EPA sends federal agents there with, armed federal agents to do execute search warrants. They have raids where they gather lots of papers, and of course the last thing they want is for companies to know we're on the way, so hide all your condemning information, right? So that's one of the reasons that EPA kept the information secret up until now, there were reasons for that.
Elizabeth Shulgren, what's been the response so far to the report? Is the fourth part of the series is today.
Right. I wanted to say quickly that mm-hmm. We didn't get to this point, and I think our time is getting close mm-hmm. to being over. And Ohio did have the most plants on the list. In our analysis showed it was 52 plants out of the 383, I believe, that were on the watch list as of September. So mm-hmm. Ohio was number one as far as quantity of plants on the list. And the reaction has been, I think there were a lot of other media outlets that picked up our story and retold it for us, and I think each story that my colleagues have told, diving deep into one particular facility and how it managed to pollute so much for so long, is really revealing, and they can be examples to people who are concerned about air pollution in their regions, and it can tell you this is what people have done elsewhere, and this is what I could do. But it's not an easy thing to do. But if it's something that you care about, it is something that people have power to do.
Thanks so much for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
That's Elizabeth Shulgren. She's National Desk Reporter for NPR. We've been talking about the four-part series, which concludes today. It's called Poisoned Places, Toxic Air, Neglected Communities on NPR, all things considered, this afternoon. So check that out. You can go to our website as well for a link to the series at WOSU.org/allsides. When we return, we'll be hearing from the Ohio EPA. Stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News. Later today, the Columbus Foundation and its donors will match your gift to WOSU. But this match is only in effect for 24 hours. Starting today at 11 a.m., you can do your part and guarantee WOSU's share by visiting our website, WOSU.org, and clicking on the Big Give. That's starting today at 11 a.m.
Support for 89.7 comes from Marburn Academy, a forward-thinking school for ADHD and dyslexic students, hosting an open house Monday, November 14th at 7 p.m. More information at marburnacademy.org.
42 degrees in downtown Columbus with cloudy skies. Expect clouds throughout the day along with a slight chance of rain and a high of 48. There's also a slight chance of rain tonight, a low of 30 degrees. Some sunshine for Friday and a high of 45. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Today we're talking about the regulation of toxic air pollution from power plants, refineries, chemical plants, and so forth in Ohio. We were inspired by the four-part series that concludes today, later on this afternoon on All Things Considered. It's called Poisoned Places, Toxic Air, Neglected Communities, and it's by a team of reporters from NPR and the Center for Public Integrity. The series shows that almost 400 power plants, refineries, chemical plants, and other industrial facilities are high-priority violators of the Clean Air Act. Half of those plants are in six states, including Ohio. Joining us now is Drew Bergman. He's the Deputy Director for Legal Affairs at the Ohio Environmental Protection Agency, where he supervises Ohio's enforcement program. Welcome to the show, Drew.
Thank you, Ann.
So since 2004, the U.S. EPA, we've learned from the NPR series, has kept a confidential watch list to manage accusations that the federal government was not being tough enough on chronic polluters. Did the state of Ohio know about that list?
Before I answer that, let me just say that I'm the supervising attorney over the air programs, so I report to the deputy director.
Okay.
So the question was whether Ohio was aware of the watch list, and yes, the watch list is something that it's a management tool that was set up by US EPA to assist in prioritizing those, like you just said, the high priority violators. And it's a tool that assists states in making sure that they are diligent in their enforcement actions. And it also is a list that assists regions for US EPA. One thing that wasn't made clear in the report was that there's quite a few of the cases that are on the watch list that are US EPA lead cases. They're cases that they're the lead agency. Sometimes we act in conjunction with them. Sometimes they just take it on their own. Those cases are ones that they also are wanting to move along more quickly. And so the US EPA region is also made sure that they know about the cases on the watch list.
Has that watch list, which was developed during the George W. Bush administration, has that been helpful to the state of Ohio to have a watch list like that?
It has been helpful. One thing that is particularly helpful is that it's a way for the states and the US EPA regions to track what's happening with cases. We have our own internal lists, and this one is useful because we're in constant dialogue with US EPA on enforcement cases in Ohio. So it allows us to make sure that we're keeping track of those cases. One thing I wanted to make sure that the listening public is aware of, there's a large database the US EPA maintains called the ECHO database, the Environmental Compliance History Online. And a lot of the information that was found for the watch list could be found on ECHO. It's a public online service. It's actually a very impressive database. It includes the entire compliance history of various facilities, any notices of violation that may have been issued, any findings and orders that have been entered into. It's a very user-friendly database. It could be found through US EPA's website. It's called, again, ECHO, E-C-H-O.
But would that include emitters that are not on the watch list with
yes.
the ECHO list? So the watch list kind of distills that ECHO list further.
Right. What's useful about the watch list is that it's like I said, it's a management tool. It's an issue of timing. If something appears on Echo, it's a high priority violator, a certain period of time, 270 days goes by and there hasn't been resolution, then it pops up on this watch list. So you're absolutely right. It's like a subset of the Echo database.
Half of the plants noted in the EPA watch list are in six states, including Ohio. Does that contradict the Ohio EPA sense about who and where the chronic polluters are in Ohio? Do you agree? I mean, is the state in agreement with the federal government that these are chronic polluters and there is a problem with them?
Well, I guess it depends on the criteria that's used for a violator to pop up on the watch list. Sometimes there are, in other words, there are companies that appear on the watch list that they dispute that they're in violation. There's some that they are actually have brought appeals at the Environmental Review Appeals Commission because they dispute the fact that they are violating or that their permit term is valid. So there's a wide variety of reasons for why something has been sitting on the watch list. Often cases are in negotiations. Our usual enforcement program procedure is we send out if we're engaging in enforcement with a case, and if that enforcement is being done administratively at Ohio EPA, we'll send out proposed findings and orders, and we engage in negotiations with the company. And sometimes, depending on how serious the situation is or how complicated, those negotiations can go on for quite a while. There's also cases where we make referrals to the state attorney general's office, and those are resolved through consent orders that are filed in court. And again, often those negotiations can be drawn out because these are sometimes very complicated issues. It's our intent to get these companies back into compliance as quickly as possible. Mm-hmm. We feel very strongly about that.
Well, I was wondering, NPR reported that cleanups of big polluters in some cases have been delayed by tension between the U.S. EPA and the state environmental programs, like the Ohio EPA, and also budget cuts and a system that allows companies to estimate their own toxic emissions and that sort of thing. For one thing, I wanted to talk about the tension. At the federal level, they're not worried about keeping jobs in Ohio, but at the state level, is there pressure on the Ohio EPA to act differently in term with a company with a polluter if they also are a big jobs provider?
I think everyone has to be sensitive to the economic development predicament that the state of Ohio is facing. But I have to say, and I can't talk real broadly about the policy angle. That's more for the director's office. But I'm not aware that the enforcement program has ever been asked to back down in any way in an enforcement case because of political pressure. In fact, we are often supported, and we proceed on that basis. So I think that there can be some tension. One of the examples that's used in the report is this Avon Lake power plant. The way that the state and federal relationship works. It's a cooperative federalism relationship based on the Clean Air Act. The U.S. EPA sets the national rules, regulations, laws. The states are often the ones who implement them through delegated programs. And in enforcement, sometimes the state takes the lead based on those rules and regulations. Sometimes the federal government takes the lead. In the Avon Lake case, and I'm not familiar with the specifics, but it sounds from the report that it's a case that involves a program called New Source Review, and it's a very complicated program, and there's some very difficult legal issues that are involved in analyzing cases under that program. And there has been in the past some disagreement between the state and the feds about how to interpret those rules. For instance, if you have a large power plant and the power plant has made some changes, it results in a modified plant. Well, do those modifications rise to the level that they become major and they violate the new source review rules? And just to give you maybe a little more specifics, some of these large power plants will often replace tubes in their boilers. Well, does a certain number of tubes rise to the level or becomes a major modification of the plant? Did it result in an increase in emissions and so violate the law? So I guess I'm just using that as an example where the state has a different I guess, perspective on how to interpret this new source review law than the federal government.
The list that we were talking about, by the way, everyone, we're talking with Drew Bergman. He's supervising attorney for the Ohio EPA Air Program. The list that we were talking about earlier, roughly the same list that the Ohio EPA keeps. For one thing, I wanted to know, is the Ohio EPA's list secret like the federal government's was? Or can anyone request that?
Is this the watch list?
The watch list.
But the watch list is maintained by the federal government. So what?
But you said you had a list too.
Well, we just have internal databases that we feed the ECHO program.
Okay.
Okay. So.
And then, to what extent is funding affecting? And to what extent should people in Ohio expect that enforcement and follow up and all the things that the Ohio EPA does to address pollutants, polluters in the state, corporate polluters? To what extent should they expect that the budget cuts and the budget and the slim pickings is going to affect that?
Well, there's no question that the budget affects different programs at the agency. And, if with an unlimited budget, we would have more enforcement staff and cases would, I'm guessing, would move more quickly. But every administration I've ever worked for, including the current one, believes very strongly in compliance and knows appreciates the fact that a robust enforcement program is necessary.
Yet there's an atmosphere here and in a lot of other places where it's anti-regulation, down on regulation. They're regulating us to death. They're regulating small businesses to death. They're regulating big businesses to death. Are they not talking about environmental regulation?
Well, they're absolutely talking about environmental regulation. In fact, environmental regulation is often sort of the touchstone example that's used. But I think that a distinction has to be made between how rules and laws are developed and how they're enforced. There's been a lot of outcry among the industry about the increasing imposition of regulations on them. And so that's a question for policymakers, for the General Assembly, if it's a law, for Ohio EPA policy staff and US EPA in developing these regulations. That I view as sort of a separate issue from enforcement. Once the law's on the books, we have an obligation to enforce and make sure that these companies get into compliance as quickly as possible.
To what extent should we be concerned about the self-reporting aspect of enforcement and to the extent to which, and I don't know if it differs between states or not, whether Ohio more often than others or not allows polluters to self-report on the amount of pollution?
The self-reporting and monitoring issue is one that's a national issue. There are a lot of it's derived from federal regulations that require a certain amount of monitoring and self-reporting. It self-reporting mechanism, and this isn't just air, this is across all media. Water, for instance, has a very involved self-reporting mechanism. It's really the backbone of a lot of our ability to be able to make sure the companies are doing what they're supposed to be doing. Reporting inaccurately, there are very serious legal consequences. If you're a Title V facility, which is a major source, and you have a requirement to certify your compliance periodically through the year, and then at the end of the year you have an annual compliance certification. If that is not accurate, or if it's less than if there's information that should have appeared on that report that doesn't appear, then we crack down very hard just because we appreciate the fact that the self-reporting.
It's kind of the honor system, and if you break the code, it's got to be all the more severe in terms of ramifications.
Except there is a monitoring system in addition to self-reporting where we kind of track what they're doing versus stack testing.
Can the state afford, though, to do adequate monitoring of all the plants, power plants, everything that's out there polluting the air like they are now? Can the state afford to follow up? And if it can, then why doesn't the state just monitor it in the first place?
Well, the because of finite resources, we can't be in a plant all the time inspecting. We have a very comprehensive inspection program. The way that Ohio EPA is organized is we have different district offices and local air agencies. So the regions of Ohio are divided up, and each of these agencies' offices includes inspectors that go out, and they do periodic inspections, make sure the companies are complying with their regulations. So the program is complemented, the self-reporting program is complemented by both these inspections and also under a lot of regulations or different permits, there's a requirement that they stack test. That means that they have to periodically test their emissions and that we can track what their test results with mm-hmm. what they're self-reporting to make sure there's an accuracy there. A lot of the bigger companies have continuous emission monitors, SEMs, and SEMs are very accurate, very high-tech mechanisms for tracking emissions. So I guess the system is kind of it's multifaceted, both self-reporting. There's testing that we observe and make sure they're done correctly. We do our own inspections, but we can't inspect everybody all the time. I mean,
mention that list, the EPA's watch list includes 383 power plants, refineries, chemical plants, and other industrial facilities. Half of which, of all of those, are in just six states, and most of them in Ohio. Is that something that Ohio is aware of? And is Ohio's EPA, the Ohio Environmental Protection Agency, is it funded adequately to be that state that's producing the most pollutants?
And I don't know the specific statistics. I know that we're one of the top six. I mean, obviously, we're a large industrial state, as is Texas right. and some of the others on the list. So there are a lot more plants and factories out there. We do what we can with our budget. Our budget is derived. We're not a general revenue fund funded agency.
Right.
We are funded by fees that are imposed on companies or permits fees with a company.
And who determines the permit fees and the fees in general for the EPA? For a higher EPA, how are those set?
Yeah, the Title V fees, which are a large part of this for the air budget, are derived from federal requirements. For if someone is a large major source, they have Title V permit, they need to pay fees based on what they emit. A lot of the permit fees are based on state law, so it would be, I guess, ultimately, the General Assembly would decide what the appropriate permit fee is, I believe.
Okay, Drew Bergman, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate it. Drew Bergman, the supervising attorney for the Ohio EPA Air Program. Coming up, we'll hear from an environmental activist who's been following this issue for about 20 years. Stay tuned. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Receive daily updates from WOSU by liking our station on Facebook or by following WOSU News on Twitter. Another way to connect with us is by subscribing to our Daily News Loop e-newsletter. Visit WOSU.org/email to sign up.
Coming up later today is an exciting 24-hour giving event that supports 89.7 NPR News. It's the Columbus Foundation's Big Give. The Big Give is a 24-hour giving event with $1 million of match money available. Starting today at 11 a.m., so in just about 20 minutes, the Columbus Foundation and its donors will match your gift to WOSU. This match is only in effect for 24 hours. You can do your part and guarantee WOSU's share of this match by visiting our website, WOSU.org, and clicking on the Big Give.
Support for 89.7 comes from the state auto insurance companies providing home, automobile, and business insurance products and services to Central Ohioans since 1921. State Auto is on the web at stateauto.com.
And in 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, Hour 2 of All Sides begins with a discussion of Montessori education methods and research. And then later in the hour, young musicians performing for a cause. Join us for Hour 2 of All Sides at 11 o'clock. There's a slight chance of rain today, cloudy skies, a high of 48 degrees. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
We're talking about the regulation of toxic air pollutants and hazardous emissions from power plants, refineries, and chemical plants and other industrial facilities in Ohio, and a report this week by NPR that since 2004, the U.S. EPA has kept a secret watch list of chronic polluters. The list includes some 46 Ohio businesses. Joining us now is Teresa Mills, probably not 46 Ohio sites. Joining us now is Teresa Mills, the Ohio Children's Health Organizer for the Center for Health, Environment, and Justice. And for more than 20 years, Teresa has worked as a grassroots environmental activist, roughly the length of time since the update of the Clean Air Act. So welcome to the show, Teresa.
Thank you, Ann. Pleasure to be here.
The September version, because there were two versions of that EPA watch list. We didn't get to that earlier, but there were two versions, includes 383 power plants, refineries, chemical plants, as I said before, industrial facilities, half of which are in six states, Indiana, Wisconsin, Louisiana, Illinois, Texas, and Ohio. Did you and your colleagues know about this list before the NPR reported on it this week?
We didn't know about a separate list, as the previous speaker talked about. You know, we do keep a very close eye on the US EPA webpage, ECHO, which actually shows there are a great many more high-priority violators than the ones that were shown on NPR.
So what do you make of that list? When you looked at the list and you compared it to what you already know about what's out there, what does it look like the list is shooting for?
Well, what I would hope it would be shooting for is to bring the high priority violators into compliance quicker.
Were those
seen that?
So were those mainly the high priority violators?
Yeah.
In your opinion?
Yes.
Okay, so they're hitting that nail on the head.
They're hitting some of them. Yesterday I ran a search on ECHO, and there was, just by putting in the high priority violator, there came up just in Ohio 128.
My guest is Teresa Mills, Ohio organizer for the Center for Health, Environment, and Justice. If you have a question or comment for her, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Alex in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Alex.
Yes. This actually refers to your previous guest.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, that's okay. He was speaking about the regulations and the punishments if the energy companies are not reporting. I have a comment about the Gulf oil spill. The BP and Halliburton were also supposed to report and make environmental impact statements to the Minerals Management Service, and they made a mockery of that system. Why does this individual think that these laws are going to be enforced here in Ohio, and why does he think that these companies are going to self-report accurately? It doesn't seem like there's a stick to make sure that they do that.
Okay. Thank you, Alex, for that call.
Thank you.
Teresa, our previous guest, as you know, Drew Bergman from the Ohio EPA, said that when the self-reporting, the honor code of self-reporting is violated, there are tough sanctions against those companies that don't fully report or don't truthfully report what they're putting out there. Do you agree that the sanctions are strict enough, as our caller just mentioned?
Oh, absolutely not. There are many cases I've been investigating for 20 years in the state of Ohio, and many times all they do is slap them on the wrist, possibly give them a little bit of a penalty, but not much. No, I do not see this, you know, dire consequences for failure to accurately monitor.
When I was scanning the list that they had, the U.S. EPA's list, and there were some explanations, some of the the companies gave explanations for what they thought was going on, and in some cases they had been fined $10,000 or $15,000 or $25,000. Isn't that a lot of money?
Not in a company's bottom line. That's chump change.
What do you otherwise make of the list and the EPA's decision to start sharing the list with the public? It was only through a public records request, a Freedom of Information Act request by NPR, that it came to light. But they, one of the reasons why they said they weren't making it public before is it helped them keep it close to their vest, play it close to the vest, so that the violators wouldn't know they were being targeted for enforcement.
Well, I can potentially see that, and I hope the exposure of this list doesn't stop that from happening. I think that's a very important that criminal investigators do have the ability to go in, we'll say under the dark of night or under secrecy, to make things happen. But I think this is a good thing that this list has been revealed.
We also talked about potential tension between states, state EPAs, and the U.S., the federal EPA, and that the states also are looking at jobs. And in this, during the recession and the recovery of the recession, whatever we're in, there's a lot of everything is about jobs and creating jobs. Do you sense that there's any pullback in enforcement in the United States or in Ohio, given the economy now?
I do see both within the federal EPA and the Ohio EPA, a pullback of enforcement. I receive an enforcement list probably every week, every 2 weeks from the U.S. EPA, and I have seen their list drop. And I'm really not familiar right now with what Ohio EPA has done with enforcement. You just don't hear it. You don't hear that they're taking an enforcement. And if they are, they should let the public know.
The NPR reported that cleanups have been delayed in the U.S. because of tension between the U.S. EPA and the state programs, budget cuts in a system that allows them to self-report. What about that tension between the U.S. EPA and the Ohio EPA? Does it make your job any easier or does it make your job tougher?
Sometimes it does make my job tougher. I must say that in 20 years, I've probably had to turn to the U.S. EPA to get an enforcement action taken. It's very difficult to get an enforcement action through the Ohio EPA. Granted, I have in some cases. I've worked on sites that the Ohio EPA has stepped up. But in most times, I've had to turn to the federal EPA. And, yes, you can always feel the tension between the two agencies.
For average citizens, people that aren't experts in it like you are, haven't been following up for a long time, but suspect that there's a problem with a factory near them or a power plant near them, what's the first step someone should take?
Well, Ann, the very first thing I do when a community calls me and talks to me about a perceived problem is I go to the U.S. EPA ECHO database.
See if somebody else already knows about it.
Right. To see if it gives you a lot of information. It gives you the TRI information, whether companies in current violation or current compliance with their permits. It gives you a lot of information. So that's usually where I have community start is the U.S. EPA ECHO database.
Have you been listening to the NPR series?
Oh, yes.
That concludes today? Is it the kind of stories that for someone who doesn't follow it as closely as you, it's going to make a big difference, but for you, it's like, yeah, of course that's been happening.
Yeah.
I mean,
but I'm so happy that NPR did this because of people that aren't like me that have been following this for 20 years. The mom and pop that lives next door to the factory, if they hear the NPR story, they'll go, oh, I knew I was right. And there was this secret list and someone is watching it. So maybe I just need to be a little more vocal because now this is verified that we do have a problem.
Were you comforted that there was a secret list out there, knowing that the Bush administration was taking seriously the criticism that was leveled at it back in 2003, 2002?
Mm-hmm. Was I comfortable with that?
Knowing that they had at least started a list.
Well, I was comforted with the fact that they started a list, but I would be much more comfortable if I knew that list had actually made a difference.
The Center for Health, Environment, and Justice was founded by Lois Gibb.
Correct.
resident of Love Canal in Niagara Falls, New York, a neighborhood that was built on a toxic waste dump. It's iconic now. And is there an important lesson from Love Canal that people can that you take from that that can still be applied today?
Absolutely. And I think that is work locally, you know, take care of your community. If we have enough people out there taking care of their own community, then that will indeed take care of the state. So, you know, citizens out there, if you have any concerns, you know, speak up. Let us hear about them.
One of the stories from the NPR series and the Center for Public Integrity series is a family that has stuck to their guns for several years now, insisting that a local entity, I think it's a power plant, has been polluting. The whole town is against them. They're trying to drive them out. What about in cases like that?
You mean the whole town is trying to drive out that local community?
The family.
The family. I would still say stick to your guns. I was involved with a power plant issue here in Ohio when I first got involved many, many years ago. The mayor and everybody was in it, and it's the village of Cheshire. You know, the first time I was involved with Cheshire, you know, the mayor didn't want to say anything. They didn't want to do anything to upset AEP. And when I left the meeting that one day, you know, I looked at the mayor and I said, well, you know, that's fine. That is your decision and I honor your decision, but I will be back. And 10 years later, I was contacted by the current, you know, the mayor at that time and said, you were right. We need you. So persistence pays off. And I always tell community groups, it takes constant pressure, constantly applied to all agencies, and it takes strong shoulders. I've been called everything from a communist to
things you can't repeat on the air.
Yeah. You know, this crazy housewife. Well, you know, I've come to the point where I wear those titles proudly.
Dave and Bexley, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Dave.
Hi. I don't know if you're strictly talking about air quality issues, but Columbus had some water quality issues. The tributaries to the Ohio River, Scioto River, some other areas had to be in compliance with the Clean Water Act. And I just wondered if there was any follow-up on that as far as how Columbus is complying. And if you wanted me to ask an air quality question, there's also issues with our air quality being one of the worst in the nation. You could answer some questions on that.
Okay. Thanks, Dave. What about our air quality being one of the worst in the nation? Surprise?
Years and years and years, Ohio has ranked number one in the nation for the amount of toxic releases into our air. So, no, our air quality doesn't surprise me at all. What surprises me and really bothers me is the lack of ambient air monitoring across the state. We have very few monitors around the state of Ohio.
That means consistent monitoring
consistent
at all times.
Consistent monitoring,
okay.
Right. And the ones that we do have aren't necessarily located in the most problematic areas. And then just to drop back a little bit to talk about the water. Yes, Columbus has had a big problem with combined sewer overflows. I'm particularly familiar with the Scioto River from the Green Lawn Dam down to the Ohio River. And there's been fish advisories on there for many, many, many years, you know, not to eat fish. You know, they contain PCBs and chloridane. I think that's the two chemicals that are on the watch list. So, you know, I think Columbus is trying, but they're only going to do as much as we push.
Do you feel like the push comes enough from the environmental protection agencies at the federal and state levels?
I think sometimes the agencies do have their hands kind of tied. And
in what way?
Well, you know, the jobs, you know, it might hurt jobs. It's going to cost too much money. But, you know, we still have to look at the outcome. You know, okay, it's going to cost this much money, but how many lives will it save by spending that much money? You know, we shouldn't put everything to a cost-benefit analysis. You know, how much is a single life worth? You know, we shouldn't be doing that.
Dan in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi. First of all, I want to thank Teresa for all the great work she's done. Teresa, it's Dan Stewart, and I just appreciate everything you've done over the decades that you've been involved in this. And I guess the question that I have for you is, you know, I listened to the earlier the gentleman from the EPA talk about, well, we don't really have the resources to do those things. And just to follow up on your comment there, I think what we've gotten to, and how, I don't know how we deal with it, and if you have comments on it, is to the place where, you know, people like Governor Perry, who's running for president, saying that's one of the agencies, once he finally remembered what agency he wanted to cut, that he wouldn't get rid of the EPA. And this sort of Grover Norquist view of life that I don't want to kill government, I just want to shrink it down to the size to get it in a bathtub and drown it, is absurd that we have to have protection. People, you know, you want your meat inspected. You don't want E. coli. You need to have safety things in there. But we get into this thing of no regulation. It's bad. It hurts business. We have to start to change the mindset, because as great as work you do, you have very little resources. How do we start to change the mindset, you know, to say these things are important? You don't want to overtax. You don't want to overregulate. But you have to have standards to protect people's lives.
Okay. Thank you, Dan Stewart, for that call. Do you want to respond to that, Teresa?
I think that one of the most effective ways that government has shut down the agencies, whether it be Ohio EPA or US EPA, is to reduce their funding. And when you have an agency that depends on the industry for their funding,
like the Ohio EPA
does.
Yes,
like the Ohio EPA does. You know, for every pound of pollution that a company emits into our air, they pay Ohio EPA so much.
Mm-hmm. And that's what they have to depend on.
And that's what they have to depend on. So the more that a company releases into the air, the more money Ohio EPA makes.
But
when we're not
monitoring.
The more
they have to monitor and the more they have to work
right,
at it.
Right, but we're not monitoring. You know, and we're doing very little inspections. You know, very few. We don't have enough inspectors to inspect all the facilities that we have in the state of Ohio.
Well, Teresa Mills, we're going to have to let it go at that. I want to thank you for joining us today and hope you come back sometime.
Thank you, Ann.
Teresa Mills, Ohio organizer for the Center for Health, Environment, and Justice. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Life is only on Earth, and not for long.
Kirsten Dunst stars in the new psychological drama Melancholia, about depression and the end of the world. On the next Fresh Air, Dunst talks about making the film and working with the controversial director Lars von Trier. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins later today at noon. This is WOSU 89.7, WOSU HD 1, and WOSU 820 Columbus, and streaming online at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media.
Support for 89.7 comes from the Physicians Free Clinic and Voluntary Care Network, providing charity medical care for Central Ohio's uninsured patients. More about joining the Columbus Medical Association Foundation and supporting the clinic is at goodhealthcolumbus.org.
The Columbus Foundation and its donors will match your gift to WOSU. It's the Big Give, and this match is in effect for only 24 hours, and it starts right now. You can do your part to guarantee WOSU share by visiting our website, WOSU.org, and clicking the Big Give. 44 degrees in downtown Columbus, clouds today, a high of 48. Cloudy skies tonight with a chance of rain and a low of 30. Good morning. It's 11 o'clock.
Much of the talk about education in America is focused on test scores and academic achievement, and most schools are organized like factories. More than 100 years ago, Maria Montessori had a wholly different idea. Today we'll talk to an authority on the topic of the Montessori method and about her book. It's about scientific research that bolsters the theories behind the Montessori method. That and a short concert are coming up after the news on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.